After 25 years in the fashion industry, I've realized that fashion is not really about the clothes, it's about the people. I'm Laura Van Root Poole, and this is What We Wore. Elizabeth von der Goltz is my longtime friend and a widely respected fashion industry leader. It was so special to talk to her about her journey through fashion from her dorm room at Harvard Business School, where she's focusing on her next chapter of leadership. Then she will begin her new role as Chief Fashion and Merchandising Officer at Farfetch and CEO of Browns of London. I am so excited to talk to you. I'm going to try to act like I don't know any of the answers to my questions, but I really don't actually. We mostly talk about family and we don't really talk about work that much when we're together, but we've known each other since we were 15, 16 years old.
I know. It's been so long. It's kind of crazy.
It is kind of crazy. I know. I just turned 51, so it does feel like a long time. You are from Hong Kong. You were born there and grew up there?
No, actually, I was born in New York City.
That
happened. Yeah, born in New York City, but it just happened to be when I was born, my parents decided to leave. So I was 1 month old and we ended up moving to Tokyo. Then we moved.
Oh, wow.
I lived in Tokyo for, I think, from that age until, I want to say, 3.5. Then we moved to London, then lived in London till I was 7. And then we moved to Hong Kong. That's then where my family stayed. So mostly grew up in Hong Kong. Yeah.
Had your parents both lived in Hong Kong before at all, or that they you all moved together for the first time?
No, I mean they moved when it goes way back. So when the communists took over in China in the '40s, I'm gonna say, that both their families moved to Hong Kong. They didn't know each other then, but they both moved to Hong Kong. And then they end up going to university and graduate school in the States. And they met through friends over there.
Do you remember much of London?
I actually had really fond memories of London. Actually, it's funny, when my parents came to visit after we moved there, we've almost been there 6 years now in London, and they came to visit and we actually went to walk past our old house. So I remember that street, it was on Platts Lane and it was in Hampstead. Hampstead is right by this amazing park called the Heath. And the Heath is...
But Elizabeth, I've been swimming in the ladies' pool. I've gone to the pond to swim.
Yeah, so the Heath is the most beautiful park, I think, of all of London. It's pretty incredible.
Sure.
And we could walk there from our house. So it was the kind of park where like all the trees you could climb on. I was a real tomboy. So it was like the perfect park. Like and I spent so much time there. So I remember that. I remember horseback riding. I remember brownies. I remember riding the double-decker bus. I went to the American school there, which was in St. John's Wood, which is still there. So no, I have a lot of fond memories of London. I've always loved it there.
And then what was it like moving to Hong Kong?
Hong Kong is like this bustling, super crazy city, busy, sky rises everywhere, but kind of amazing. And you know, when you move, this is my father's job. And actually what's super fun is when you are that age, is we live in a hotel. So every time we move, we live in a hotel. So back in the day, it was the most famous hotel in Hong Kong in that it was like the 80s, the Hilton, right?
Yeah.
And we lived there for a long time. And that was just super fun. Like you could just run around the hotel. And I know this is really weird, but he was really famous. The elevator boy wore the full outfit.
With
you every day. Like he wore this little Chinese outfit with his hat. We'd greet you every day. I mean, I was 7 years old. So this was like, I literally felt like I lived in heaven.
So. Did your fashion change when you moved from London to Hong Kong? Do you remember being into clothes forever?
So the minute I think I could talk and tell my parents I did not want to wear pink, I was like, I really, really disliked pink as a young child. And I think the minute I could tell them to like not make me wear pink, I was, you know, I did. So I would say I was totally a tomboy. My 6th birthday, my invitation said pants only.
Really?
And yeah, I think that's really where, and I was a little bit older then. My parents loved to travel. So like they loved to shop. They loved to go to Europe. They loved to go to Italy. So, and I started to really love fashion probably around, I would want to say probably like 10, 11, I probably got really, really into it. It was probably around that age. And then from there, it was my life.
I think you and I both, we always loved boys' clothes.
Yeah. We used to fight over Laura's boyfriend's jeans, old Levi's at boarding school.
All Levi's cords.
Yeah, exactly.
Will you talk to me a little bit about your mother and your grandmothers?
I really have an incredible, incredible family. So my grandmother on my father's side was actually the first female lawyer in southern China. She was a defense lawyer for Japanese war criminals because wow. She worked for the government. So she had a tough, but she was a real power woman. I mean, she was one of the first women to fight for women's rights in China and all that. So she was extremely, extremely like, you know, super intelligent, but very strict. She was very old school and she was very, very, very hardcore in that sense. And then on my mother's side, you know, very different. My mother grew up in a family where she actually lived on an island that was all foreigners because my grandfather actually ran Standard Oil for southern China. And she had a very different kind of upbringing. My grandfather on that side actually had three wives at the same time. So there was a lot of siblings. And my mother happened to be the daughter of the youngest and last wife. My grandmother was married off when she was like 14. Growing up, she always told me I should never get married. And she was like, you should be independent. Like, you don't need to. Anyway, so that was also like a great influence in that sense that I never felt pressured. And then my mother said, because she was the youngest daughter of all these children, that she always wanted her father's attention. So she just like excelled at school. I mean, she was just unbelievable. My mother, like, you know, she ended up going to Bryn Mawr for undergrad. And then she got her PhD in chemical physics from Harvard in the 60s, mid 60s, I want to say. She was the only woman in her entire class. She always just did whatever she wanted in life. And she was just, you know, someone you wouldn't come across. Like, she literally was a space cadet half the time. Like, you want someone who's so intelligent that they're like not rational or logical, but they like live in another planet half the time. That was like my mother, but she was, and she always loved to have fun. Like, she just was someone who loved life so much. And unfortunately, she passed away last year from Alzheimer's. I think of her all the time, especially now that I'm here at Harvard. It kind of means a lot to me to be here.
Yeah. So. She had a very successful gallery of Vietnamese artists, correct?
Yeah. Think of her. Like, she was a scientist, you know, obviously. And then when she finished school, so in the 60s, she said basically most of her classmates went on to become professors at major universities. And I went into academia, but women weren't hired to go into academia. So she actually went to go work for IBM. But then when she married my father, he kept moving because of his work. And she just kept changing. It was amazing. Like, I don't know how, like, I think about it now and it's kind of amazing. After IBM, when we moved to Tokyo, foreign women, because we had American passports, weren't allowed to work in the 70s. So she went to go do research at the university in Tokyo. And then we moved to London. She ended up working for British Telecom and sort of selling optic fibers to China and taking delegations over there. Anyway, super like something different. And then when we moved to Hong Kong, she started a consulting firm. And then I was really mad. I remember thinking my brother went to Andover before us, as you remember, you really did. And then I went away. And then my mother, the year I got in, she decided to stop working. And I was like, why would you stop working now? You've worked your whole life and now we're going away. And I was like, I was super upset. I was like, this is like, why now? Like, now you're going to be home. And she was like, no, now I'm free to fly over to see you guys anytime I want. So anyway, the way her mind worked was just different. But anyway, so when Vietnam opened up to the rest of the world, she and my father started going just personally, and they just fell in love with all the art there, because it was because of when it was under French rule, there's an École des Beaux-Arts, so there's that whole influence with the artists there. Yeah. And they end up collecting, they end up meeting all the artists, traveling all over Vietnam, and it was just a personal passion. And then she literally decided one day to just open an art gallery, or the first Vietnamese art gallery outside of Vietnam, and she was super successful at it, and she'd never done anything like that before.
Did you always want to leave and go to boarding school? I mean, did you ever see a different path for your life, or is that what you always wanted to do?
I think when you're that age, you don't even think about it. I don't even, my parents were like, you're doing this. I mean, Hong Kong is really small and you kind of end up knowing everybody in the school I went to. So many kids end up going away to school, whether it's to England or Switzerland or the States. So in the end, you kind of want to go because being left, I think there was like the graduating class that I left behind, like, was six people. So it was kind of a natural thing to go away at that time. And I think in my head too, I think my brother didn't want to go to A school, but he went to the American school, which was, I think, like more fun than my school in Hong Kong, which was a German school. But I think, you know, my head was always like, oh, what are the American, you know, what is American high school like? I thought it was in, like, the movies. Like, we don't experience that, like, American high school life I see on television. But Andover's not that. Andover's not that, I'm sorry.
But you and I both are obsessed with those shows and those movies. I do know that, and the clothes. But do you remember when we met for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, we lived in the same dorm, right? I think it was my, it's like, well, that was my, you know, my, the whole experience was so crazy for me. It was like, you know, it was like, I've never been in a town, like I'd been in America a ton. We used to go to the States every single summer, but I had never been in a small town. Like, I remember my mother saying like, this is not even a, she called it the Ville. She kept calling it the Ville. Like, it wasn't even a village. It was like a Ville.
That's hilarious. Surely. I love it. Did you ever imagine that we would end up in a similar career path?
No. I mean, I think that's what makes our friendship so special, especially because Andover, everyone's so intense. Everyone's like the extreme. We always say this, they're extreme of what they do, but they're, everyone's so like either academia driven, but they're very driven in a very either financial, like financial world or the academic world or just something. It's like fashion isn't something you ever even talk about there. It's like just no one does it, right? It's like, so for the two of us to have been friends, live in the same dorm and end up in this industry is just super rare.
So after high school, you went to Georgetown. And what did you study at Georgetown?
I studied art history at Georgetown.
With such high performing parents, especially a mother, did you feel pressure to pursue a certain career or were they supportive?
I think because of what my parents were that like I didn't want to compete. I was like, I'm never going to go to science. I'm never going to find it. It was just like one of those things. Like, it's funny. My brother's like, Yuli studied philosophy in college and I started art history. We literally like ran the other direction, which is funny. And I think it's so hard to, when you have parents like that, to be in that world. And I think they also said, it's really interesting. Cause I remember my mother saying to me, listen, you know, my English was so poor when I went to school in America, and what's science and math are a universal language. So,
right.
I mean, but my parents, like, they love art, they love culture, they love history, they love philosophy, they love literature. So I think they kind of knew that they're bringing us into this life that they were excited that we could do different things and explore new areas that they weren't able to when they went to school.
So post Georgetown, did you go straight to work in New York and straight to Barney's?
No, I didn't know what I had no idea what I wanted to do after school. I mean, literally, I remember like, I think everyone sort of, you know, showed off about their new job or where they're going, where they're working. And I had no clue what I was doing. I remember I had this joke. I don't know why I thought it was funny at the time, but I just, when everyone asked me what I was doing, I said I was moving to Argentina and going to marry a polo player.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like some people took me seriously, but I was joking, but I didn't know what I was doing. And then, you know, I moved back home to Hong Kong. I really was just like, I honestly don't know what I'm going to do. I moved back to Hong Kong. I kind of just lived a great, fun life for a little bit. But then I became the person I said I never wanted to become. And I remember Amanda, who's one of our other really good friends who went to boarding school with us, who I grew up with, came to visit me and said, this is the thing you told me you never wanted to become. So she really like shook me out of it. And I remember growing up, we didn't know fashion was a job, right? No one we knew was in fashion. And so interesting enough, like this woman, Joyce Ma, who is really an icon in fashion. She's probably the cheapest woman I've ever met in my life, but she brought all the most famous designers to Asia, to Hong Kong, to China.
Yeah.
And her store at the time, which now she sold. Yeah, Joyce was the mecca of fashion in Hong Kong. And I love that store. And luckily, so Ho Jun, who was at Andover with us in your class, his sister was the chief merchant of Joyce. So once I found that out, I went and I said, can I meet your sister? And I went to go meet her. And I said, if I want to do what you do, what should I do? And she said, move to New York. I moved to New York. I had no job. I moved to New York.
Yeah.
And I just got there. So, and when I got there, I actually ended up temping this agency. And I said, just put me in fashion jobs, you know, and my goal was Barney's. Right. So I think I did different, like, I think I worked in like the GQ closet one day. I like did reception at Calvin Klein one day. And actually the person who managed me was really mean to me. And I wish I knew who they were now. They're really mean to me. And then I end up temping in the operations department of Barney's, like, which is like on another floor. It's like the unglamorous behind the scenes operations. But I worked super hard. They knew I wanted to work in buying office. And when an opportunity came up, that's how that all started.
You went straight to the buying program?
They didn't have any buying program. So usually assistant buyers had to have some experience. So I wanted to be in like designer in one of those areas, but I didn't have the experience. So I'm actually really grateful and lucky because I ended up being the assistant buyer to the private label, the Barney's private label, which had a designer, Ronald Vanderkemp, who I love.
Yeah.
And I really, in that area, you learn basically how to make a garment. So you learn all like how many meters about like you need to make, you know, production. Whatever. Yeah, all about production, all about exports, all about the percentage of different kind of materials. I mean, it was sort of amazing to start there because I learned so much about not just buying and fashion business, but about like how you make and sell clothes. So,
yeah, that's incredible. And that's really rare. And tell me, will you talk to me a little bit about Barney's at the time? Why was it so special?
Barney's was like the mecca of fashion in New York. They're the ones who brought like all the Belgians into the U.S. They brought the Japanese designers into the U.S. It was like just really, really forward thinking, cutting edge, super, just really stylish, really chic, really cool. And the time I was there was still the Pressmans. The Pressmans were the family that founded it. But it was a tough time. I think my like second month, the company went into Chapter 11. So
yeah.
Thankfully, my salary was too low for me to get cut. So I made it.
They're like, she's basically working for free.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it was at this time, after a few hardcore Barney's years, you decamped to Los Angeles.
Oh, no, that was later.
Okay.
I got stolen away by Bendel's. For I went to Bendel's for like 6 months.
But that was interesting. One thing that I learned from you there that I have always tried to continue here in Charlotte, I remember that the buying team had to work on the floor one day a month.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We spent a lot of time.
I loved that.
Yeah.
And that store was really, I mean, just the space was so, the apartment was so beautiful.
Yeah. No, it was fun. It was 6 months. It was super fun. I mean, at the time we did all these events. Like we did events for like the launch of Cruel Intention. I mean, we literally hung out.
You really did.
Sting for some reason. Like it was super fun. It was a crazy, crazy time. But I was six. So I was there for 6 months because after that, what happened was, so Bergdorf's was like the super sleepy kind of grand dame of New York at the time. And I think, so they brought over like the president from Barney's, they brought over all these people from Barney's to kind of freshen it up. Then they asked me to come over to Bergdorf's to buy, which was for designer, which was my dream job. So that was amazing. But I had someone who I worked for who was, okay, let's just say she was amazing at her job. I mean, she taught me so much of what I know today. I mean, she was phenomenal at merchandising, phenomenal with financials, and had fantastic, amazing taste, but she was a very difficult personality and a very poor leader. And, you know, it was tough. And this was like very Devil Wears Prada kind of days. She was supposed to be who I was supposed to become. And I remember thinking, I don't want to be her. I don't want to be that. And I actually took a break. And that's when I took the sabbatical and took a little sabbatical and left.
It was a fun sabbatical.
Yeah. It was a very fun sabbatical.
And it was like 2 years?
It was 2 years. So 1 year I traveled. So I went home to Hong Kong for a bit, which was amazing. Because once you go to boarding school, you're never at home. I traveled with my mother a lot. We did some really phenomenal trips. I did some other great trips with friends. And it was the right time because it was when all my college friends were like in that in between kind of going to kind of graduate school time. So they had a lot of free time. So I did some amazing traveling. And then I ended up I went to LA and I worked on this. I was a costume designer for this movie called Taboo, it actually had some famous people. Janet Jones was in it and the guy from American Pie, Eddie. Oh my God, I'm not gonna remember his name. But anyway, Eddie K. Fisher, I think that's his name.
Okay.
Anyway, we filmed in Romania and it went to got into Sundance, that movie.
Wow, I didn't know that. And then you worked for a small designer in LA, which I think was probably pretty interesting too. I mean, just to see everything from that side.
Well, it wasn't a small design. Actually, what I ended up doing was working in a showroom. Exactly.
Yeah.
In K-Side's showroom, Hatch. And we represented a bunch of, you know, quite a few designers. And that, it was fun. It was fun. It was just being on the other side. But I end up basically, like all the clients we had end up basically doing their buys for them.
I'm sure. And so you obviously missed it. I mean, I imagine you got headhunted to come back, but you must have missed it.
Bergdorf's had called me several times throughout the period, and I wasn't ready. I think everyone knew. I didn't want to explicitly say, but everyone knew why I was leaving.
That the boss was tough. Yeah.
And this person ended up becoming a problem there was actually left the business. So when she left the business, finally they called and said, you know, please come back. This person's gone. And at that point, I'd been in LA for a year. And living in LA for a year as a New Yorker or a city person that's very global, it was like, I felt like I needed to eject myself and go back to reality. So yeah, it was the perfect time. So yeah, so then I moved back to New York and went back to work at Bergdorf's, and then I was there for then 17 years.
And tell me about that. What are some of the milestones of that 17 years?
What I love most is because of the experience that I had, it was really then up to us to create this culture. And I think we really created a culture that was inclusive, was fun, and everyone worked really hard. We were very goal-oriented, but you know, it was kind. It was about being a family. And I think it was really important for me to be in a place that I felt had that kind of environment. And I think that we really created something special there. And I think that the team that we had there, like, they're still my family. You know, I walk in that store. I mean, all the sales associates, they've been there for over 30 years. I mean, they were like my mothers. Like, I know all of them. Like, I still walk in there today. And it's like, I hug everybody. And it was this amazing environment. And Bergdorf's, because we're going through this transformation of bringing it into the future, but keeping that heritage, it was this amazing, magical time. And, you know, we really, really did, you know, we threw amazing events. We did massive renovations of every single floor to really create like customer flow, all the things we learned about being customer centric, all these things, like that's what we did there. It really was a magical time. I loved it there. I really had a really, really special, special the whole 17 years, I have to say.
It's so rare in this business to stay somewhere that long.
Yeah, it really is. And I still, a lot of them are still there, you know, and they're still super close to me.
Jim Gold always told me that you were the smartest person that he's ever met in fashion.
Because very nice to hear.
He was your boss, but it's rare. I mean, I think you have everything. You're able to be personable and charming and beautiful, but you have incredible taste, but you're also incredibly bright. You have all the things.
Thank you, Laura. Well, so do you. No,
but I think it's rare. I think it's really rare. It's like your whole life sort of culminating into that first moment.
You know, I think, you know, what's interesting, it's like someone like you and like both of us, we love like life. So we love art. We love to travel. We love food and everything that is in these experiences. It all, for me, it's like, it's very anthropological in a sense, right? It's like, what do people wear? Like, what do people wear throughout history? What do they wear when they're in the city? What do they wear when they're in this country? So I feel like it's so much, it fits into this life that like you and I both love to live. And that's rare to have a job or do something that does that, you know. I think it
touches all sides of yourself. I totally agree with that. So towards the end of your tenure at Bergdorf, e-commerce started to really come on heavy. What was that like? Was it scary? I mean, was it like, what did y'all feel like at the time? I mean, this is now 10 years ago or something.
Yeah. You know, what was interesting though, what was really interesting is Neiman Marcus Group was super forward thinking when it came to e-commerce. So they started their website, I mean, before anyone else. And what happened was when I was at Bergdorf's, they ran the Bergdorf's website out of Dallas. And the site was basically exactly the same. It just said Bergdorf Goodman. And at that point, you know, when I was at Bergdorf, so we're like, okay, let's take over the site ourselves. We got to make it Bergdorf's. We got to make it our edit, our curation, our content, our look and feel. So I actually spearheaded, like I had like our senior team fly down to Dallas, like go in. Mm-hmm. So we started to take over part of the website. And so we did that like in my last 2 years there, I want to say. And that got me sort of really be like, okay, this is super interesting. It's a whole different way of looking at things. And it's sort of the future. And I think after being at Bergdorf's for so long, you know, I had this like tugging feeling that I'm so comfortable. I have this amazing life here. My office literally overlooks Central Park and, you know, was like designed by Linda Fargo. It was the pinnacle, right? But then part of me, like, this is way too comfortable. I'm too young to be like not pushing myself. And I knew I wanted to make myself uncomfortable again. And I knew I wanted to do something that was more future thinking.
And was that totally from you or was that from your husband too? Or was that just totally from within? I think that's who you are, but I want to hear
it. It was totally from me. And I don't want to be political, but there was a weird time where that summer in July, I was in Paris during Remarket and Brexit. They announced the Brexit vote that was a yes, like they were like Brexit was happening. And I remember thinking, this was way before the primaries hadn't even happened in the States, but I literally went, like, I went forwards. My mind went straight to, oh my God, Trump's going to win the presidency. Yeah. I don't know how I wasn't even the primaries yet. And I remember I went back home. I said to Andreas, I said to my husband, if this happens, like, I want, like, we're going to leave. We're going to leave New York. And I never say things out loud unless I mean them. And I was like, so we were like, where would we live? And we always talked about living in Europe. And I said, we want to live in London. That's probably where we both be happy. And yeah. I swear, like a month later, I got texts from two different designers who I'm really close to saying, the president of Net-a-Porter wants to call you. Is that okay? So this whole, it's sort of like, you know, when you say things out loud, that sort of thing, like, I want to move to London. I want to move to something global. I want to do e-commerce, digital. And I need to like make myself uncomfortable again. Like this all kind of just happened. And it was the perfect opportunity. So I took it.
So tell me about Net-a-Porter. What was the learning curve like? I mean, was it completely different from what you'd been doing?
I was a global buying director there, which is kind of the chief merchant there. And what it's very similar in the buying aspect of it, right? But what's amazing is that when you're in a store for so long, and this is what I loved about it, the challenge is how do you make a website or e-commerce luxury site feel like your favorite neighborhood store? Like, how do you bring that personality to it? And so that was sort of my challenge, which I loved. I mean, the buying strategies, they're different because you have a global customer and it's much bigger, but right. It's similar in how you approach a buy with your taste level, et cetera. You just have a broader customer base. And, you know, I would say, but so much of it is how you draw the buy into the content and into the marketing, which I always love to do because it's just so much, it's so creative, you know, and the way you have to push things. And the learning curve was really on things like, you know, visual merchandising, you know, the online merchandising, all the kind of the performance marketing, paid marketing, digital marketing, all of that, digital media, all of that was sort of, that was really more of the learning curve, which is so vital to everything today. So I'm so, like, again, really grateful that I was able to pivot at that time and pivot my career, because without that digital experience, I wouldn't be, you know, where I am.
Yeah. I remember I had a unplanned drink with Natalie Massenet 15 years ago. And she knew what I did. And I said, I know where every single thing I sell, I know where it goes. I know whose house it's in. You know, I know, I usually see pictures of it after, you know, when they're worn. I don't understand how you understand what you're selling. And she said, well, I have this screen in my office on the wall. It's a map of the world and it lights up where I'm selling things every day. And I was just like, oh my God, that just, you know, it's just like lifetimes away from what I do. I'm selling it to like person down the street for me.
Well, you have this data, right? You when you're in a store, you never know where they really from, what city they really live in. Like when you sell it online, you have this amazing amount of data. It's now then what you use and how you use the data, but you have amazing insights to your customer, but also, you know, the personal touch is important too, because personal shopping has become really, really important in e-commerce businesses and private clients. You meet them. I mean, I hosted a lot of events. I hosted clients at shows. Like, you do want to still meet your best clients all over the world. And so with Net-a-Porter, I traveled everywhere. I mean, we were in Dubai. I was in Sydney. You know, we were in LA. We were in Beijing. I mean, we went all over the place.
And what was the corporate environment like compared to Bergdorf?
First of all, it's like the office is this massive open office. So your desk is in the middle of a sea of desks. It's not like I sat in my little pretty perfect office perched over like Central Park. So super different, you know. It felt a lot more democratic in that sense, but it still had the vibe of a startup, because these companies were, they grew so fast and they're so new. So there was a lot, that part was like, it was really, I was there really to create more structure, better, stronger foundation, things like that, because it sort of just grew so fast. It was like this massive growing company and still had the startup mentality when it needed to kind of probably mature a bit to go to the next level, the next phase. Yeah.
The teams you'd led before had been buying teams, I would imagine. Was that difficult to lead people with a different skill set, I guess?
It's really similar, that function, I would have to say, but it's just that they need to think a lot broader. And it's interesting, like the differences I found is in the States, you get very good people, they're very analytical and they're great with the financial part of the business. But I would say they don't have this natural instinct or taste, because they probably haven't traveled as much, or I don't know what it is. And in Europe, you get people who've got a great instinct, great taste, but they weren't brought up with the kind of merchandise planning that you are in the US stores. So it was a right. little bit of, so it was about really, really, you know, trying to push their strengths, which was like amazing instincts and taste, but then also trying to bring in a little bit more, you know, accountability when it came to the financials and analysis. So it was a bit of a kind of a melding of the worlds.
What were some of the biggest challenges during your years at Net-a-Porter and Matches?
I mean, COVID happened in the middle.
I was going to say pandemic. Yeah.
Pandemic was really, really tough, especially, unfortunately, in this particular day, closed down two warehouses, which for us, for me, was a real pity because I said, I'm the kind of person who will go after every opportunity. And when I know I can gain market share, it's something I will aggressively do. And it was really hard to not be able to do that during a period where all the stores were closed, and it was the perfect time to be able to do something like that. So that was, you know, and that was hard. And it was also like when your team is just spread out all over the place, you have a really large team and some of them are really young and they're all at home and scared. They've never been through, you know, we've been through 9/11. We've been through 2008. Yeah. We've been through stuff with, I had team members who did.
Yeah.
And I remember like we actually did a Zoom with everybody on it to have a panel of like who'd been through difficult times and how we got over them, and kind of we sort of let people ask questions and had this open forum, which I think was so important. And then, you know, Matches, you know, I would say I was the chief commercial officer there. And, you know, I think it's such a beautiful business, this heritage that it had. And it was really about coming in and really elevating the fashion again. And it was, you know, and it was a really great from a fashion point of view. I think the challenges were that, again, a business that grew really quickly. I'd been sold to private equity.
How have you found support personally or professionally through these roles? Have you? Or do you figure it out on your own?
No, I mean, you know, I have this thing here that's something actually my living group here at HBS that we talked a lot about. Like, we're all leaders, so we're not good at asking for help. But
yeah.
Of course you need to. I mean, of course, like, first of all, I have Andreas, my husband at home, who's the biggest support of my life, and I could never do what I do without him. And so he hears everything. And of course, I have sort of, you know, a few, you know, my right hands who obviously I like to shield them from some things, but like, are there for a lot of support. And then I think it's really important that we all have, you know, mentors or people we're close to in our network and friends or business-wise that we work with that know us, that, you know, you can always reach out to when you have a question or you need advice or, you know, you want to talk about something.
Will you tell me about what you're doing and what's next?
Yeah, so I left Matches in September and I was like, okay, I'm going to take a full six months off. And, you know, my goal was to take a little time with my husband, travel a little bit, but then meet and talk to everybody. You know, I've moved from job to job my whole life because, first of all, I felt like I wanted to, but someone called me and I said yes, right? So that's how the movement happened. I never took time and said, what do I want to do with my life? Where do I see my future? What do I want to do? So I was like, okay, I have time. I want to do this. I want to take the time to really think about this. And everyone, you know, my mentors, all the people, everyone told me that, you know, Jim Gold, Josh Holman, everyone's like, you know what you should do? Just meet everybody. So I talked to, you know, everyone in the industry, from designers to CEOs, to private equity, to venture firms, to, I mean, every single search firm, obviously, out there. And I just said, you know, I'm just going to meet everybody. And it's weird. Like, there's always part of me that regretted not going to business school. But at the time I was doing, like, even when I took a sabbatical, I didn't want to go to business school. So it's sort of like one of those things. And then, you know, when you reach this point in your career, you're like, well, actually, like, I could teach an MBA class if I wanted
exactly.
to. So you're kind of not at the point, yeah.
I say, like, if you got through 2008, you could teach a class for sure.
So it was one of those things. Andreas was like, you know, you've always wanted to go back to school. This is the perfect time. And literally his father called one day and said, the perfect program for her is the AMP. So it's the Advanced Management Program at Harvard Business School. And he had done the Owners Program, you know, a long, long time ago. And when I went and looked it up, it literally, like, the description of this course, I was like, this is it. Like, this is exactly what I'm gonna do. You know, it's basically for people who've been in their industry for over 20 years. They're on, you know, they're in an exec board level. And it's really a leadership program. And it's a lot about finding purpose in what you do and about transformation and about always looking forward in your business. And it's been incredible. So it's a 4-month program. So I'm here, I'm living on campus now for the last three and a half weeks of it. And it's been an amazing experience.
And what have you learned about yourself and about your leadership?
I would say, you know, I was so nervous coming in here. I don't even know why. Like, you know, when you're a leader, your whole life, you're like, I can walk into a room with like 10 CEOs and have no problem coming. But I was so nervous coming here just because no one's in fashion here. Everyone's from like big pharma and like Coca-Cola and like big banks and, you know, so I was really intimidated. And then when I got here, we have a co-executive coach as well. As a woman, sometimes you're like, okay, well, when I meet new people, because we have living groups here of 8, so I have a living group and it's a whole cohort of 160 some people. You don't want to come across like too overpowering or too loud or too this. And you have these, all these things you think about yourself that you try to like minimize, you know? And my coach said quite early on, because we had to do this, every living group had to do this Mount Everest exercise simulation. Anyway, it's super interesting, but it went really well for us. And my coach said to me, he's like, you know, and I was talking about being humble and feeling the need to kind of sometimes like kind of downplay myself. And something he said was just like, you know what, like being humble is great, but never make yourself smaller. So that's like, then like I remember that like every day now, you know, and I think,
yeah,
like, bring yourself, be yourself, like even starting a new job. You're like, how do I come across?
Yeah.
You know? And then, yeah, and just my best advice is be yourself, like just your authentic self, bring that to the table. And that's probably the best you'll be able to do.
How do you think female leadership has evolved in fashion over the last 20 years? Do you think it has? Because when I found out you were in this program, I did text you. I did say, like, this industry has, it needs leadership. Please lead us. Please. We'll follow you, you know, because you are the person that will lead and will change, I think. I think you're the person that will do it.
It's, you know, I've been really disappointed with the roles females, women play in leadership and fashion. And it's interesting being here because everyone is shocked when I tell them there's more female CEOs in finance than there are in fashion. And they can't believe it because there's so many women who work in fashion. The US probably has a few more than the Europe. When you look at all the biggest fashion brands and companies, they're all led by
men.
True. That, you know, went to business school, right? And worked in consulting. So it's really interesting, but the tides are definitely turning. When I had my break and talked to a lot of, you know, the big search firms, they said to me, a lot of companies that they brought in these CEOs are not working. Their strategies are not working. And they're like, the next tide is coming. And everyone knows it's about like bringing in leaders who, first of all, have as much EQ as IQ, as much instinct and knowledge of fashion than just finance. And I think it's starting to change, but we have to show the way. And the longer I've been here in school, it's sort of now something I think about of being a mission that like we all have to be role models and really, really, you know, really pave the way for the women in this industry for the future.
What do you hope your legacy within the industry will be?
I had co-founded a nonprofit called Raise Fashion, where we mentor BIPOC designers. And I think we've now created a fellowship program, which is really about trying to help them sustain their business for the long time. I think that's, again, so, you know, really mentoring kind of emerging new talent. And then this whole leadership part on and have it really hoping that we can be the role models to bring in more women into CEO positions, leadership positions, running businesses like yourself, entrepreneurs. I think that's sort of where I want my legacy to go. Right now, that's what I think, believe.
Are you proud of the leader that you've become in spite of how you were groomed? It's like you've come out better than they trained you.
Yeah. You know, everyone learns in different ways, right? Some people become the person that trains them. I think the way I learned was a lot of things was what I don't want to be. And that really helped guide me. And then I took the best of the best leaders and the best bosses I had and kind of tried to blend them into one. I would say I am proud of the leader that I am, but I think it's important that you always are trying to grow and evolve and improve. And I think me even being here is part of that. Like you're never like a leader and boom, that's it. Like you've done it. You've hit the pinnacle. I think you have to always be open to constantly change and improve.
Well, you do because your team changes.
Yeah.
I mean, it completely changes. I mean, I've really seen that post-COVID especially.
Well, we're lucky because we work, you know, in fashion, like we always work with the youngest generation, right? We work like every year, the people that come in your team, we see all the different generations and like, you have to know how to communicate with them. You have to know what inspires them. You have to know what motivates them. Like, and you have to bring them on board. Like back in the day, it was so top down, right? You just told people what to do. And now it's like, that is not how it works. Like you got to bring everyone with you. You have to listen. You have to ask their opinion. You want them to be on your journey, on your mission. And that's it's a different way of leading.
What's been your biggest personal evolution as a leader along the way?
I think it's trying to be more vulnerable. I think, you know, you grow up as, especially as a girl, as a woman, you're like, I need to be strong. I need to show no emotion. I need to be in there and act like, you know, that I have no weaknesses and only strengths. And I think I'm still working on this. It's to be like, it's okay to show that you've got bad days. It's okay to show that you've made mistakes. It's okay to show sometimes that you're not sure. It's okay to be just more vulnerable. And I think that's so important as a leader too.
And it's so not what we were taught early on.
No. And also I'm Chinese. Like we're not supposed to show any emotion about, like, you know, so it's even harder.
Yeah. What would be an example of what you would see in the future generations of female leadership that would make you know that things are different and better beyond the number of CEOs?
I mean, it's not even that we're not even talking about it anymore. That it's just not even a topic.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, we don't need to talk about it because it just is.
Yeah.
Maybe we talk about how few men leaders there are now.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. I'm a year ahead of you, and so I don't think I was with you at the prom, but I feel like I know what you wore, but tell me what you wore to the prom.
I had it made in Hong Kong, so I sort of designed it myself. I wish I had a picture, but I don't have a picture. I was trying to be very, like, sophisticated and chic, so it wasn't that exciting. It literally was a crepe de chine mini dress that was, like, navy black. Blue on top and black on the bottom. I mean, it was like...
Oh, that sounds chic, though.
Quarter sleeves, a perfect little shoulder, like, you know. Ugh. Yeah. Anyway.
That sounds pretty. We had such a boring prom because it was at the dining hall, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. Yeah.
So not glamorous.
Not like the high school prom from John Hughes movies, let's just say.
Yeah, that you and I are obsessed with. I love you so much. I love talking to you, and I'm so proud of you, and just really enjoyed being able to have an hour-long conversation with you.
I know. I love you too.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drazda. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.